Previously on No Other Way. Veteran Marine Claudia Vasquez recounted her violent assault at the hands of a fellow Marine during her tour in Afghanistan.
What are you doing?
I'm teaching you some respect.
In recovery, her nurse Sophie regaled her own story of abuse.
You think you're the only victim here, Claudia?
Claudia later killed and buried Sophie's attacker, before tracking down her own to begin planning his demise. In present day, Claudia realized the voice's identity, Harvey Nolan, a fellow soldier she met in Afghanistan while investigating her prisoner Kasimi's missing daughter. Nolan clued her in to a covert child trafficking ring between the U.S. and Afghan governments.
Our government wouldn't tolerate that, much less have a hand in it.
I wish I lived in that world, but I'm starting to think that world never really existed.
Officer Sam Pierce recognized the government building where the first nuke was located as a place he was prohibited from when investigating its connection to a shady company.
Venture Industries Incorporated or something?
LLC.
Yeah, that's it.
Fellow Officer Pope warned Sam about investigating it any further.
I need to get a hold of our venture contact.
Venture Industries? You want a coffin with that?
I didn't set Mac up. You worried I'm gonna find out who did? Or you worried what else I'm gonna find?
Financial analyst Martin Chen was threatened by his client, trafficker Vera Diaz, for the attention surrounding the warehouse where Officer Mac Devlin was murdered.
What have you told them?
Nothing. I haven't said anything.
Then why did 40 officers just surround my goddamn warehouse?
Escorted by Claudia, Martin visited his father-in-law's mansion to retrieve his wife and son, whom he hid to avoid Vera's wrath. As Claudia waited outside, Martin formed a plan to escape without her.
We have to disappear, and I think I know someone who can help.
What about Claudia?
Using his wife Angela as a shield to prevent Claudia from shooting him.
Marty, stop it!
Back up, get back!
Damn it, Martin! You're gonna get thousands of people killed!
Martin ran Claudia down as he took off with his wife and son in tow. FBI agent Brubaker, in pursuit of Harrison Gailey, an associate of The Voice, authorized police to send a drone into Gailey's shack to torch and burn it down. Gailey escaped, but was later captured and interrogated by Brubaker, who secretly poisoned and killed him to get back at The Voice.
Your move, asshole.
Ex-crisis negotiator Frank Cole sought out his former lawyer and fixer, Albert O'Malley, regarding a clue that may lead them to The Voice.
Venture Industries?
That doesn't ring a bell.
Frank's old boss and mentor, Captain Orson, who once suggested Frank enter politics years ago.
Maybe we can sway him to run for office, huh? What do you say?
Visited the residence of Les Kaminsky, a suspect whose home The Voice's signal was traced to.
And I don't pal around with terrorists either.
Someone could have tricked authorities into believing that you were a threat.
Orson later met with Frank, Claudia, Sam, and Martin to discuss his suspicion of Brubaker.
Agent Brubaker get a chance to interrogate the driver?
Yeah, then the guy came down with a sudden case of death.
The Voice's last cryptic message.
The Voice said, we'll leave it up to the revolution.
And the impending TV interview of Rashonda Mickelson, awaiting trial for her retaliatory murder of Officer Devlin.
Her damn TV interview is tomorrow. The city's already on edge.
Orson also presented them with items located at the government building, which included a piece of fabric from the dress of Kasimi's daughter.
Any of these items look familiar to you?
No.
Claudia answered deceptively. That night, Frank got a call from The Voice himself, offering him a chance to be a hero again.
What do you say, Frank?
What took you so long?
And now, Chapter 5. A peacefully silent bedroom. Mrs. Orson lies in bed in a deep sleep, a dreamlike smile across her face. By contrast, beside her lies Captain Orson, who couldn't be more awake. He stares at the ceiling, his brain seemingly never turning off. A thought suddenly strikes him, and his eyes go wide. He slips gently but quickly out of bed, puts on his slippers, and leaves the room. In his personal office, Orson fastens his robe, flicks on a desk light, and takes a seat. His desk is a mess of papers, folders, and post-its, but it makes sense to him. He easily slips through the chaos and pulls a folder. He opens it, sifts past report after report, then stops on a photo of Harrison Gailey. Orson withdraws a magnifying glass from a drawer and focuses on Gailey's tattoos. He examines each one until a particular one grips his attention. An arm tattoo where only the word revolution is visible beneath the rolled sleeve. Orson shuts the folder, turns his attention to his computer, and taps away. The Long Beach Police Department site pops up. Orson opens a folder containing Gailey's autopsy photos. He studies the arm with the tattoo, now able to read it in its entirety. For the revolution. Orson looks uneasy. He types away again, this time more frantically. He peruses Les Kaminsky's social media posts and photos breeze by. He stops on one particular photo of Kaminsky, flexing muscles shirtless on a beach. A shoulder tattoo reads, "For the revolution." Orson's jaw drops. The magnifying glass hits the floor. Mrs. Orson rushes in, startled awake.
Sweetie, are you all right?
This is bad. This is really bad. This is really, really bad.
Chapter 5. You have no idea. An SUV with tinted windows sits to the side beneath a dirty, barren underpass. Behind the SUV, a police cruiser pulls to a stop. Officer Pope exits the cruiser and strolls up to the driver's side of the SUV. As he approaches, the window lowers, revealing FBI agent Brubaker.
I thought Sam was going to help lead us to the Voice. Instead, he and his new friends are dicking around Venture Industries.
As the Voice intended, I'm sure.
Do we need to take care of them?
Those four are the best chances we have of finding this guy. We eliminate them now. We're back to square one.
They keep pulling at that string. What they could unravel? It won't just be Mac. A lot of good cops could go down.
The threat this country's facing goes above and beyond the plight of your fellow officers, Pope. What's at stake here is our very way of life. Now, we're gonna keep a close eye on them. And if they lead us to this lunatic, like I think they will have solved both of our problems.
And if they uncover Venture first?
I put them together. I'll tear them apart.
Brubaker's window closes and the SUV pulls away. A modest two-level home sits quietly in a mild-mannered suburban neighborhood. There's a knock at the front door. Paul, a tall, wiry fellow, annoyed and pissed, swings the door open. Sam stands at the doorstep, wearing a gleeful smile.
What do you want?
Good morning, sir. I'm with the Property Inspection Service. May I have a moment of your time?
No.
Property owner's orders, I'm afraid. They've been under strict instructions to get these buildings up to code, and I'm afraid that includes impromptu inspections, such as this.
In the back room, Frank climbs through a kitchen window and tiptoes towards Paul from behind.
I ain't getting no notice about no inspection.
You should have received an email from management, sir. Check your spam folder, perhaps?
I ain't got no damn email address.
Well, there's your problem right there.
Get lost. I'll take this up with the owner.
Don't bother.
Hey, what the hell?
Frank forces Paul into a corner. Sam rushes in and locks the door.
How did you get in here?
That's the least of your worries.
Frank pulls Paul's hands behind his back and binds them. Sam duct tapes his mouth shut.
Have a seat.
Frank tosses Paul onto a couch. A perplexed Sam pulls Frank to the side and speaks in confidence.
You want to tell me what we're doing here, Frank?
Yeah. I do.
But he doesn't. Instead, Frank continues inspecting the house, leaving Sam sharing the same confused look as Paul. FBI Headquarters, Los Angeles. Amidst the lobby's daily hustle and bustle, A monitor in a corner broadcasts a promo featuring the histrionic voice of news anchor Shar Weston. Orson watches from a lobby bench. On the broadcast, photos whisk across the screen of Rashonda Mickelson and her late son Josiah hugging at a dinner table. Josiah on a high school track field. And Rashonda's mugshot as animated cell doors close over her image.
Guilty. Justified? You be the judge. Join me as I come face to face with the woman herself. I'm Shar Weston, and don't miss my live one-on-one interview. Innocent Murder, a moment with Rashonda Mickelson. Today at noon, only on WAGC.
Orson rolls his eyes. Brubaker appears, stepping briskly in his direction. Orson rises and rushes to keep up as Brubaker hurries toward a corridor.
Captain?
We need to investigate every hashtag we can find on revolution.
Come again?
Yeah, revolution. The revolution, for the revolution, anything like that.
What's going on?
Has there been any word on the location of the second nuke?
No. What's this about?
Gailey had a tattoo on his forearm. For the revolution.
Okay.
Kaminsky, for the revolution. Right here.
Orson points to his shoulder.
In the Voice's last live stream, he said, "We'll leave it up to the revolution."
What are you thinking?
I think they're the Voice's followers. And if that's the case, who knows how many others are out there, or what they're planning.
You're riding an awful lot on a hunch, Orson. We got two similar tattoos. For now, that's just two nuts who fancy themselves revolutionaries.
But if I'm right, and there's a wider plan to this thing, how many steps behind are we?
I'll have our cyber unit look into this.
One other thing. You ever heard of Venture Industries LLC?
Brubaker's demeanor shifts.
Venture Industries?
Yeah, they came up on that warehouse where Officer Devlin was murdered.
I'll look into that one as well. In the meantime, pay another visit to Kaminsky's. See what he knows about this revolution. I'll have someone meet you there.
You're not tagging along?
I'm following up on a lead.
Do tell.
Top secret security clearance on this one, I'm afraid. Keep me posted.
Brubaker exits through a stairwell, leaving Orson in the hallway.
You keep me posted.
Orson replies sarcastically. In the stairwell, Brubaker speaks into his phone.
It's Brubaker. Thank you for reaching out. You're doing the right thing. No. Not even Orson. I'm sure the Bureau can work something out. Where can we meet?
On the other end of the line, Martin Chen, who paces back and forth in a motel room.
I'm at the Desert Shore Motel, room 118. You'll come along?
You have my word, Mr. Chen.
Martin hangs up. He approaches Angela, who sits on a couch with their son Miles in her lap, avoiding eye contact. She holds Miles tighter as he gets closer.
Can I speak to you for a moment? Angela, please.
Angela releases Miles, stands, and follows Martin out of the room. Outside their motel room, Angela maintains a distance between herself and Martin.
FBI is on the way. I'll tell them everything I know about the Voice. They'll help us disappear, and this will all be over.
She remains silent as she stares off into the distance.
Angela, I'm doing this for you. Both of you.
She starts back to the room, but Martin takes her hand, holding her in place.
Angela, I had no choice. Claudia would have only made it worse. With what I know, the FBI can track this guy down and this threat will be neutralized. And we'll be able to disappear. In peace.
She lets him hold her hand a moment longer, before gently pulling it away and heading back into their room, leaving Martin to his thoughts. Outside the Long Beach City Jail, police erect barricades and set up security checkpoints as news vans and protesters begin to arrive. Inside, a security guard passes a row of jail cells until he reaches a particular one. He unlocks the door and opens it,
Mickelson, it's your big day. Let's go.
Rashonda Mickelson, in prison uniform with her hair astray, slowly turns from her lower bunk bed to the cell door, her face drained of emotion. She pulls herself up from her bunk. Frank and Sam have each pulled up a chair and are now sitting across from Paul, who works his body to sit upright on the couch. Frank leans into Paul and rips the duct tape from his mouth. Sam works to hide his confusion at the situation as he attempts a poker face. Paul makes a feeble attempt to wriggle free.
Who are you? What the hell are you doing?
We're waiting.
For what?
You don't know?
No. Get me out of these.
What's your name?
None of your goddamn business.
We're gonna need a bit more cooperation than that.
Paul, okay? My name is Paul.
See? That wasn't so bad, now was it, Paul?
Paul takes quick, intermittent glances past Frank and Sam to the window behind them.
You have to let me go. I gotta be someplace.
Where's that?
Work. I'm late for work.
Well, that's unfortunate. What is it that you do, Paul?
What?
Your job. What is it?
I'm a clerk at a law firm.
Paul steals another glance at the window, which does not go unnoticed by Sam.
Expecting company?
What do you mean?
By my count, that's the fifth time you've checked that window, Paul. Who are you waiting on?
A look of unease crosses Paul's face. Outside the mansion, a bruised and battered Claudia rests on the ground, leaning against her car as she speaks on her phone. She winces as Angela's father attends to her wounds, swabbing a bruise with alcohol.
Yeah, it's Medina Estates in Woodland Hills. No idea. They just mowed my ass down and took off. They could be anywhere by now. Can you meet me at my place? I'm gonna need a ride. I didn't ask for an ambulance. I asked for a ride. Okay.
She puts her phone away as Angela's father fixes a bandage around her arm.
Ah. Thank you.
My daughter and grandson, are they in trouble?
As long as they're with that shitbag, yeah, we all are. Did your daughter say anything about where they were headed?
No. But the car they borrowed? It has a GPS tracker.
You don't say.
Orson's car pulls to a stop in front of the Kaminsky residence. A police squad car is already present. He exits his car, makes his way to the front door, and knocks. The door opens to reveal Officer Pope, standing by, ready to assist.
Captain, suspect's detained in the kitchen. Down the hall, to your right.
Officer?
Orson nods and enters. Pope peers around outside before closing the door. More news vans have now gathered outside the Long Beach City Jail, and the crowd has multiplied. Protesters yell at one another with their respective Team Mickelson and Team Devlin t-shirts and protest signs. By the WAGC news van, Char Weston sits in a director's chair. As a makeup artist and hairstylist perform their final touches, Char studies a script in her hand and rehearses her lines.
Such a harrowing experience. Such a harrowing experience. Such a harrowing experience.
Inside the jail, a guard escorts Rashonda into a room and toward a chair on one side of a steel table. Camera lights are set up around the room. A small crew performs camera and lighting tests. Before Rashonda is seated, the guard discreetly pulls something out of his pocket and slips it into hers. She wears a look of confusion until the guard leans into her ear and whispers reassuringly,
"For the revolution."
Rashonda retains her surprise as she takes a seat. At Paul's house, Frank's phone rings. He heads to a corner for privacy. Sam casually acknowledges it as he keeps an eye on Paul.
There's no one coming. Please, I'm late.
Just hang in there, Paulie. The more you cooperate, the quicker this will go.
Sam looks to Frank, who turns in his direction and holds out his phone.
It's for you.
Sam is completely baffled. He watches the phone lingering in Frank's palm. He exchanges a look with Paul before rising and meeting Frank across the room. Sam holds a look with Frank before taking the phone and raising it to his ear.
Hello?
Hello, Sam. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Is this a joke?
Not at all. This is a genuine honor to make your acquaintance.
Listen to me, you son of a bitch. When we catch your sick little ass, we're gonna end you. You hear me?
Sam, stop.
You hear me, huh?
Hey,
you hear me, you piece of shit?
Give me the goddamn phone. Hello? Hello?
What is this shit, Frank?
Take it easy.
Easy? He had my fucking partner killed. I'm gonna put a bullet in his head, easy.
Your partner, who murdered an innocent child in cold blood.
What are you, working for a terrorist now?
He contacted me last night. You were right. Someone is coming. I don't know who, but they've got something. Something we need. So, we wait.
Are we the bad guys now, Frank?
I think we're about to find out.
I hope you know what you're doing.
Sam tosses Frank's phone back to him and walks off. In the Long Beach City Jail, Shara seats herself across the table from Rashonda. Around the periphery of the room, a small crew finishes their final lighting adjustments. A cameraman situates himself behind the lens. Rashonda sits in silence, her mind adrift. Shara takes notice and leans toward her.
Mrs. Mickelson? Mrs. Mickelson?
Shara outstretches her hand and melodramatically places it on Rashonda's. Rashonda snaps out of her drained despair, and her eyes meet Shara's.
Are you ready, hon? Would you like some water before we begin? Please, thank you.
Shara nods to an assistant, who locates a bottle of water and places it before Rashonda. The cameraman gives Shara a 3-2-1 countdown, and Shara switches on the charm as the broadcast begins.
Rashonda, thank you for joining us today. I know this has been such a harrowing experience for you. Tell me about your son.
Josiah was my world, my light. And that light has been extinguished.
How does that make you feel, Rashonda?
Feel?
Angry? Saddened? Vengeful?
I'm beyond feeling. I am beyond where a mother should ever be. Josiah would have been 19 this week. He should be starting the rest of his life right now. But he won't. And his killer walked free. And we're told to just move on. How?
Shara turns her phony grin to the camera.
How do you move on? We'll be right back.
The cameraman cuts as they go to break.
Wonderful. Just powerful, powerful stuff, Rashonda. Could you maybe just sit up a bit straighter? You're not quite fully in our key light.
Rashonda adjusts her posture as she gives Shara the side eye. In his house, an irritated Kaminsky slouches at his dining room table across from Orson, who scribbles in a notepad.
I've been downtown already. I told you guys everything I know.
And we appreciate you taking the time, Mr. Kaminsky. There's just a couple of details we need to iron out. I assure you this won't take long. Had you experienced any internet service interruptions or outages prior to the hack?
Not that I know of.
Had you visited any suspicious chat rooms lately?
What do you consider suspicious?
Any platform prone to fostering talk of cyber attacks, violent threats.
Talk? You mean like speech? I thought that was free.
It is. But not from consequences.
No, I don't fraternize with riffraff. I'm a law-abiding, tax-paying citizen, just like you.
Fair enough.
With the same freedom and the same rights as you.
Easy, Mr. Kaminsky.
What's next? You gonna restrict what websites I visit? What tattoos I can have? What groups I can join? How many freedoms will you people restrict in exchange for some false sense of security?
Orson's face changes subtly as he eyes Kaminsky a bit differently now.
Mind if I use your bathroom, Mr. Kaminsky?
Down the hall to your left.
Orson nods agreeably and is on his way. As he passes through the foyer, he stops by Pope and speaks to him in confidence.
I didn't mention anything about the tattoos. Keep an eye on him. We're almost done here.
Pope nods as Orson walks on. Claudia waits outside her apartment. A car pulls up and she rushes to the passenger door. Squeak emerges from the driver's side and runs over to help her in. He sprints back behind the wheel and takes off. A bit more nervous than usual, Squeak resumes a conversation on speakerphone.
Okay, Sarah, I gotta go now.
You'd better be back here in 1 hour. You hear me?
I will do my best.
I'm serious, Eddie. I've got my salon appointment and a yoga class right after.
I'm well aware of your schedule, Sarah.
Well, act like it. Get my damn car back here in an hour.
All right, I gotta go now.
Thanks for the lift.
Don't thank me, thank my ex. It's her car now, along with the house and every other goddamn thing.
Looks like he's hiding out at a Desert Shore motel near Long Beach. Checked into room 118.
Long Beach? I can't make it there and back in an hour, Claudia. My wife would kill me.
Ex-wife, Squeak. And this is for the greater good. She'll understand.
Hey, you two have clearly never met. Oh, jeez. Yeah?
Did you just hang up on me, Eddie?
No. Yes. Hun, I gotta take care of something. And I need to concentrate on the road now.
Don't hunt me. I'm so sick of your disrespect, Eddie. And you better fill up the tank before you get here, too.
Look, bitch, we're dealing with a national emergency here. And this country is at risk. And in case you haven't noticed, you live in that country. Your ex is being noble and trying to prevent a domestic catastrophe. So go stretch your self-centered ass out in a corner somewhere until he's done. Got it? Better yet, just call goddamn Uber.
Who the hell are you? Who the hell is that, Eddie?
There.
Thanks, Claudia. That really smoothed things over.
We gotta get to Martin before he disappears for good.
What is he hiding?
No idea. But if he's willing to let the world burn to hide it, it can't be good. I think I know who the voice is.
Who?
Private Nolan. Remember him?
Nolan. Harvey Nolan?
That's him.
How do you know?
He left us a clue. The fabric from the dress from Cassimi's daughter.
What does it mean?
Yeah.
It's Frank. How's it going?
Not good. That slick little shit tried to run me over and bailed.
Martin, are you all right?
I will be, once I get a hold of his ass. I'm tracking him down now.
The voice. He reached out to me.
The voice reached out to you?
Yeah. He told me to give you a message. He said, they're safe.
Claudia tears up with relief upon hearing the news, as if years of weight had suddenly been lifted. Squeak takes notice.
What is it?
Claudia?
Yeah. I'm here.
Any idea who we're dealing with?
He was a private I served with in Afghanistan. Who he has become now is anyone's guess.
I think he's on the other line. I'll get back to you.
Copy that.
Claudia hangs up.
Nolan found those girls.
I wonder how many more there were that we never found.
They both ponder that thought. At Paul's house, Frank and Sam sit at the kitchen table, both with an AirPod in one ear. Frank hands his phone over to Sam.
Yeah.
Sam.
That's me.
Are you ready to listen now?
I'm listening.
Good. This next step is very important. In the next few minutes, someone will be at that front door. That someone has a key. Find the door to that key.
Could you be any more cryptic? Who's coming?
Someone you've been looking for.
What did we find on the other side of that door?
Justice.
The voice hangs up. Frank and Sam share a look of puzzlement. They return to the living room and Frank kneels down to Paul.
Who's coming through that door?
You should leave. You don't want any part of this.
Any part of what?
A car pulls to a stop outside.
Too late now.
Frank replaces the tape on Paul's mouth, then gestures to Sam to flank one side of the door as he takes the other. Both draw their guns. The door is unlocked. As soon as it opens, Sam lunges and grabs the figure. Frank shuts the door and rushes to duct tape their mouth. Both are in shock as they realize the figure is Albert O'Malley.
You?
You?
Frank and Sam exchange a glance that says, you know him too? Outside the Long Beach City Jail, protesters begin fighting one another. Officers rush in to separate the skirmishes and use barricades to push the protesters further from the building. Arrests are made, which only intensify the mood. Inside, the TV crew take their places as the camera rolls again. The cameraman gives Char the countdown as she flashes her smile and resumes.
We're back. Thank you all for joining us. And again, thank you, Mrs. Mickelson, for your time. Your husband, Arnold Mickelson, is an attorney, is that correct?
Yes.
He has a reputation for bringing litigation to Los Angeles area precincts. Is that also correct?
He fights wherever there is injustice.
Which he feels is rampant in the city's police force. Isn't that right? Do you feel that may have played a part in Josiah's death? Could this have been some sort of retaliation? Mrs. Mickelson? Do you need some time to...
Losing my only child was the worst day of my life. And I will relive that moment forever.
My question was about...
Police are murdering us. They are murdering our black babies. The only way to stop this is if we, the citizens that they're sworn to protect and serve, unite against this abuse of authority. We can take this power back. We need to take this power back.
I understand, but we...
Because it's not just us anymore. It's the most vulnerable of this society. It's the mentally challenged, the elderly, our unarmed, defenseless citizens. They are all someone's baby. They are all our babies.
The crowd outside gets more riled up as Rashonda's words begin to resonate. Both sides now seem to be hanging on to her every word in mutual agreement for once.
Mrs. Mickelson, I need you to relax.
They can't kill us all. We will unify. And we will fight together as one America. And if we do not get justice, we the people will take it by any means necessary.
Let's take a commercial break.
The broadcast ends. Char's sweet-natured persona is now fully removed and her tone infused with a barely withheld rage.
Rashonda, listen to me. I understand what you're going through. I do. But I need you to stay focused and follow my lead. We'll give you time for a final word once we conclude this segment. But for now, a little more structure and a little less power to the people. Do you understand? Rashonda?
This is all coming to an end.
Rashonda offers a dubious smile.
All coming to an end.
As if possessed.
Very soon.
Making Char and her crew a bit unnerved. The power goes out.
What was that?
Some sort of power outage.
I can see that, genius. Why?
I don't know. Blew a fuse, maybe?
We're back in less than 2 minutes. Figure it out.
The assistant and crew mill about, searching the wires and outlets. In the midst of the confusion, Rashonda, calmly and patiently, takes a sip of her water. FBI Los Angeles. Brubaker leaves his office and adjusts his coat as he weaves between cubicles on his way out. He stops in his tracks when an employee leaps to his feet, cradling an open laptop in his arms.
Hey, he's streaming, everybody quiet!
The familiar audio wave plays on the screen, moving in rhythm with the voice's words.
The root of all evil is the abuse of power. Harrison Gailey went into the custody of the Long Beach Police Department and left, deceased, just hours later.
Brubaker grins proudly.
This is why the masses have lost faith in authority. The time has come for that faith to be restored. Have you checked your pensions lately?
The audio wave goes flat, and Brubaker's smile fades. He checks his watch and hurries out. At police precincts across the city, detectives, lieutenants, sergeants, and captains run to their desks and frantically type away at their keyboards. Some faces go pale as they quickly refresh their screens again and again. On their displays, pension statements totaling zero. Orson returns to the dining room to find an antsy Kaminsky pacing.
Are we done here or what?
Just about. I wanted to ask you one more question. What do you know about Venture Industries?
Overhearing from the foyer, Pope perks up and his eyes go wide. He peers down the hall, keeping his eye on the dining room. Kaminsky lights up.
Now we're talking.
He gestures for Orson to follow him up a flight of stairs. Moments after they ascend, Pope creeps up and lingers at the bottom of the stairs, eavesdropping just out of view. In his home office, Kaminsky sits at his computer and boots it up as Orson hovers over him.
You buy the innocent, hard-working civilians. Meanwhile, evil looks right under your noses. You're all busy protecting it.
Orson rolls his eyes as Kaminsky types and brings up a web form, opens and plays a video file.
Word online is, Venture's an arms manufacturing wreck with ties to former U.S. defense contractors.
Come again?
Venture has been secretly funneling arms to every third world country's civil war for years. They're militarizing the police force. That shack that burned down a couple days ago in Northern California, that was a controlled fire. New drone technology given to cops, care of Venture Industries. Any one of you peace officers go snooping around are either paid off or knocked off. Here's some secret footage of one of their fundraisers.
Hallway security cam footage shows the outside of a banquet hall. Orson scans the crowd of officers, businessmen, and military personnel who exit, until one individual in particular catches his eye. Officer Pope. Kaminsky recognizes him too and points at the screen.
That the guy downstairs?
Orson looks over his shoulder in the direction of the office door. He and Kaminsky leave the office and return downstairs. They both look in the direction of the foyer, the last place they saw Pope, which is now vacant. At Paul's house, Frank tosses O'Malley onto the couch, hands bound behind his back, right beside Paul.
Talk.
Frank, what are you doing here?
You first.
O'Malley turns to Paul.
What have you told them?
Not a goddamn thing.
Frank, now you listen to me. I've gotten you out of some tight spots in the past. Let me get you out of this one. Walk away from this.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Sam chimes in.
Hey, O'Malley. You remember me?
I don't think so.
I'm Officer Sam Pierce. I interrogated you in connection with a little company. Maybe you remember it. Venture Industries?
And that doesn't ring a bell, shit ain't gonna work this time.
Frank, I tell you what I know and I'm a dead man. And so is everyone in this room. I'm looking out for you as well, like I always have.
Whatever's in this house is gonna lead us to this voice.
Who told you that?
He did.
I'm sorry, Frank. I can't help you.
Sam leans closer to O'Malley.
How about we just take that key off of you and help ourselves?
Key? What key?
The one we're gonna take from you after we beat your ass.
O'Malley grows fearful. At the Desert Shore Motel, Martin lies fast asleep on the bed. A car door shuts in the distance, stirring him awake. He scans the room sleepily. No one in sight. No suitcases either. He's alone. Martin blinks wide awake now, leaps from the bed, and hurries out the hotel room door to find Angela behind the wheel starting their car, and Miles fastened to his back seat, who reaches out as he sees his father.
Angela! Angela!
Martin tries to grab the door, but she pulls off too quickly and leaves him in a cloud of dust.
Angela, please, don't leave me! He's my son, too!
The car is now a speck in the distance. Martin drops his head and falls to his knees in tears. At the Kaminsky residence,
you stay put.
Orson gestures for Kaminsky not to move as he inspects the rest of the floor.
Officer Pope.
He steps into the foyer, confirming Pope's absence. He moves into the living room, searches and finds no one. He peeks out the living room window. Pope's cruiser sits unoccupied.
Pope!
He continues down a hallway, searching his surroundings as he approaches a bathroom door, which is slightly ajar. He casually opens it and looks around. Pope appears behind him and wraps his arm around Orson's neck in a chokehold. Orson writhes and gasps for air as he struggles to escape it. He elbows Pope in the stomach and backs him into the wall, knocking down portraits and other fixtures. Orson places a leg behind Pope's, tripping him and sending them both falling back into a bookshelf. Orson's arms and legs flail about, and they fall, crashing into an end table. Pope's hold remains, and Orson's gasps for air become fewer and more desperate. Pope removes one arm from around Orson's neck, giving him enough room to break free, and Pope enough time to draw his gun and aim it at the back of Orson's head. Orson lies motionless. Kaminsky enters, cautiously and in shock.
He raised up on me. I had to defend myself. You saw everything.
No, I ain't seen nothing. I ain't seen nothing.
Pope's bullets send Kaminsky to the floor. Pope regains his breathing and calmly forms a plan. He rearranges the position of the bodies. In Paul's living room, O'Malley is thrown face down onto the floor, his hands still bound, as Frank and Sam frisk him. Unbeknownst to them, Paul, who sits on the floor nearby, has managed to slightly loosen his restraints.
Frank, I don't have any key. You're wasting your time.
Frank pulls random items out of O'Malley's pockets. Wallet, phone, lint, and a bag of cocaine.
Now it's a party.
Take it. And the money. Take it all and go. We won't say anything.
Frank throws the bag at O'Malley's face dismissively. He proceeds to rifle through his suit jacket as Sam searches his shoes. Frustrated and done with their search, Frank and Sam rise and exchange a look, then simultaneously look to the couch. They both begin removing the pillows and cushions.
Frank!
After all are removed, a bronze key is all that remains. Frank picks it up and turns it over in his hand.
Frank, please.
Guess what the next question is.
Brubaker's SUV races down the freeway as he converses with Pope on speakerphone.
One less loose end to tie up. You cover your tracks?
Yeah, we're good. Nice and clean.
That Kaminsky could have had some intel on the voice.
Had no choice. He saw everything.
Okay. I got agents on their way to take your statement. Make sure it checks out.
Understood. What about the other four?
On my way to see one of them now. I'm getting another call. We'll talk later. Go for Brubaker.
We got a major problem. We
just received word on the location of the next nuke.
Where is it?
Long Beach City Jail.
Brubaker winces at the news.
Is that where Rashonda is being held?
It is, sir. They're shutting down her interview now and evacuating the premises.
That son of a bitch. With all the prisoners, guards, media, and protesters, this city will be a veritable madhouse, and he knows it. I'll get back to you.
Yes, sir.
He hangs up, bangs on his steering wheel, and steps on the gas.
God damn it!
Outside the jail, bedlam breaks out as backup police arrive on the scene. Officers do their best to round up the protesters and usher them away from the building, which only amplifies the crowd's anger. Protesters begin to fight the officers, who resort to quelling the uprising and making arrests. Sirens blare on the inside, and red lights flash throughout the jail. Prison guards begin running to and fro in a panic. Char's crew shares that fear and begin yelling confusedly at one another. Two guards rush in. One addresses Char directly. The other raises Rashonda from her seat and slips her out of the room.
Ma'am, you and your people need to follow us right now.
What are you talking about?
We need to evacuate immediately.
Char's crew starts grabbing what equipment they can and running out to awaiting guards in the hallway.
Hey, get back here. We are in the middle of a live broadcast. We're not going anywhere.
Ma'am, I'm going to yank you out of here kicking and screaming if I have to.
You lay one hand on me, and I'll have your job. I'll own this goddamn jail, you hear me?
Reaching his limit, the guard hoists Char up and over his shoulder as he forcefully carries her through the door.
Get off me! Put me down, you piece of shit!
Guards and police work together to usher prisoners out safely, but random prisoner altercations hinder their efforts. Suddenly, a number of cell doors slide open, surprising the prisoners in them, as well as the guards outside of them. After the brief shock, the guards and police prepare for conflict. Those with shields raise them. Those with batons do their best to hold them back. The prisoners leap from their cells full force, searching for exits, and utter mayhem unfolds. Rashonda's guard escorts her down a stairwell. He opens a door which leads to an underground garage. He reaches into her back pocket, withdraws a handcuff shim, unlocks and removes her cuffs, and safely ushers her into the back of an unmarked van. The van drives out of the garage as more reinforcements are entering. It blends into traffic and disappears. Upstairs in Paul's house, Sam walks the length of the hallway. He examines the lock of each door he passes, with the bronze key in his hand. Downstairs, Frank leaves Paul and O'Malley in the living room as he wanders into the kitchen. As he passes a large armoire, he catches Paul in his peripheral vision, shifting his head worriedly in O'Malley's direction. And O'Malley holding up a hand to him, gesturing to take it easy. Frank studies the armoire before noticing that behind it, barely visible through the wallpaper, was the outline of a door. Frank sends a text to Sam. Get down here. Sam rushes down the stairs, past O'Malley, and an almost untied Paul, and joins Frank in the kitchen. Paul reaches under the couch and feels around until his hands locate a gun. Frank subtly nods to the armoire, requesting an assist. Sam takes the hint and grabs one side of it as Frank takes the other. A bullet hits the center of the armoire, and Frank and Sam leap for cover. Paul wields a gun, firing wildly despite O'Malley's pleas.
What are you doing? Are you crazy?
O'Malley distracts Paul long enough for Frank to give Sam a signal. They both grab the armoire, lunge forward, and drop it onto Paul and O'Malley. Sam pummels Paul in the face until he's out cold and takes his gun. O'Malley crawls out from under the armoire and escapes the house to safety. Frank holds out his hand to Sam.
The key!
Sam tosses it to him. Frank rushes into the kitchen, inserts the key into the door's lock, and turns it, while he draws his gun. Sam rises, now armed as well, and flanks one side of the door. Frank nods to Sam. Sam swings the door open. They enter and descend down a dark flight of stairs. Frank feels along the wall for a switch. He finds one, just as he hears something. He flicks the switch. A look of horror overcomes Frank and Sam as they struggle to regain their composure. Sam audibly gasps and turns away. Frank can only mutter,
"Oh my God."
Before them, a group of frightened young children huddled together in a corner, their sobs forming a haunting echo. On the freeway, Brubaker listens to the news as he follows freeway signs to Long Beach.
"We have breaking news this afternoon. The latest bomb scare in Southern California, and the second in less than a week. This time, at the Long Beach City Jail. Riots have erupted as authorities work fast to get guards, prisoners, and protesters to safety. And as you can imagine, it's not a pretty picture."
Gridlock up ahead brings his SUV down to a slow pace, then a halt. A ripple effect of the jailhouse chaos has hindered freeway traffic.
"Damn it, let's go, come on!"
He pulls a wailing siren out and places it on the hood, pulling over to the shoulder lane and speeding off. Martin sits on the couch, once occupied by his wife and son, eyes empty and drained as he waits. There's a knock at the door. Martin leaps to attention and races to it. He opens it to meet Brubaker, but comes face to face with Claudia instead.
"Oh shit."
Claudia's left hook sends Martin clean across a dresser. She sends kick after kick to every part of his body he fails to cover up, until Squeak intervenes.
"Enough. Enough. Stop. He can't talk if he's dead, Claudia."
"I had to protect my family."
"If you run, you can lose all our goddamn families."
She leans into Martin's ear.
"I got two burials I can show you right now. I got no problem making a third."
"How did you find me?"
"What are you doing here?"
Martin drops his head in defeat.
"It doesn't matter anymore. My wife left and took our son."
"Good. Claudia."
Squeak throws her a be nice look as he pulls a pair of binoculars and keeps watch by the front window.
"We were gonna disappear. Together. I'm meeting Brubaker, telling him what I know. I know the people responsible for arming the Voice."
"And how's that?"
"Because I helped them."
"We're getting out of here."
"What? Why?"
"I might know who the Voice is. We're gonna rendezvous with Frank and Sam and figure this out ourselves."
"No, we stay and tell Brubaker everything."
"Brubaker may have murdered the only witness in custody, Martin."
"We don't know that."
"What do you think he'll do to us once he gets what he needs?"
"I'm staying."
"You're doing what we tell you to do."
"We got ourselves a single SUV. Looks like government plates heading our way."
Squeak turns to Claudia.
"How do you want to play this?"
Martin quickly opens the door.
"Help! Help!"
Claudia slams it shut, pulls her stun gun, and tases Martin into submission.
"Well, that's that then."
Squeak gestures toward the bathroom as they pick Martin's body up and carry him there. Frank sits in his car outside Paul's house. Police squad cars and ambulances surround the house as officers usher the children to EMTs standing by. On the front lawn, Sam gives his statement to a detective. Neighbors have become looky-loos, watching and pointing from their respective porches and balconies. Frank speaks aloud to seemingly no one.
"What makes you think these cops are on the up and up?"
"Let's just say, they've been vetted."
The voice answers via speakerphone.
"Plus, the bad apples are too busy checking their empty pensions right about now."
"You gonna tell me who you are?"
"I told you, I'm nobody. But you didn't think so. You didn't see a man to be feared. saw a man who just needed to breathe.
A moment of realization crosses Frank's face.
I still practice it, you know. The breathing.
Me too. How's your wife?
She's passed on.
Damn it. I'm so sorry.
Don't be. You fought the good fight.
What's your end game here?
I vowed to serve my country, Frank. That vow didn't end at these shores. There's evil to be uprooted. Others see it now, too. And we're going to dismantle it piece by piece.
By detonating the world until you get what you want.
We have the nation's attention. Tomorrow, we'll have the world's. Find Martin. He's a crucial piece to this puzzle and the next step of the revolution. But be cautious, Frank. What you and Sam have uncovered will make you heroes. But not everyone loves a hero.
The voice hangs up as Frank retracts into his memory. 1 year earlier, Frank holds a conference on an auditorium stage beneath a banner that reads, "Frank Cole for Mayor." Orson stands in the wings, watching and filming with pride.
We deserve better. Our homeless deserve better. Yes, yes. Nearly 10% of our homeless are veterans. Veterans who were sworn to defend us. Why are they on our streets? We will create housing for the city's downtrodden and forgotten. And we can do this together.
One of those cheering in the crowd is Harvey Nolan, aka The Voice, who beams at the speech he's just heard. Later, as most of the audience has filed out of the auditorium, Frank is wringing the last hand of a supporter. As Frank heads backstage,
Mr. Cole.
Nolan is running quickly toward Frank. Orson leads security as he orders others to advance. Frank holds a hand up to Orson and his security detail, waving them off.
It's okay.
You all right, Frank?
It's fine.
Nolan arrives out of breath, though he makes an attempt to talk through it. His health has deteriorated slightly since his tour in Afghanistan, which is reflected in his gravelly voice. Frank grabs a seat and pushes Nolan into it. He holds a hand on each shoulder and speaks to him in a softening tone.
Listen to me. Breathe. Think of a calming moment in your life.
My wife, nagging at me to hang my coat up.
I said a calming moment, but...
She is my calm.
Nolan then rushes through his words out of sadness and confusion.
I can't afford her insulin. Veteran benefits are supposed to cover that, but their systems don't talk to one another, or antiquated software or some bullshit stuff. Sorry.
And rather than veteran affairs officials working on the problem, they argue over who's culpable. No, you have every right to be angry. I'm angry for you. I'm making this kind of thing a cornerstone to my campaign. I could use your help.
No one thinks about it. Is flattered, actually. But a better idea replaces the thought.
I'm of better use out there, in the crowd. But I got your back.
Frank shakes Nolan's hand.
Well, don't forget to hang up your coat.
Nolan smiles as he turns and goes. Frank joins Orson backstage.
You're a little too trusting of your supporters, Frank.
You say that like it's a bad thing. How'd the footage come out?
Perfect. I kept that mustard stain in frame the entire time. I should get an Oscar for that blocking. Look at that.
As he watches the footage, Frank rubs the stain off. A little too late.
Why didn't you say something earlier?
Because I wouldn't be able to laugh about it now.
Oh, this was for your enjoyment.
Hey, I ain't your cameraman. You get what you pay for.
Orson pats him on the back. Frank pats Orson's shoulder in return as they move out of the exit door. A beautiful memory between Frank and his mentor. A memory Frank would soon cherish even more.
You did great out there, kid. I'm proud of you. You're gonna make a difference. I just know it, know it, know it, know it, know it.
That concludes Chapter 5 of No Other Way. I am its creator, James Dinkins. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to hear more, please feel free to donate to our production at paypal.me/DinkinsFilm. That's paypal.me/DinkinsFilm. And be sure to follow us on social media at No Other Way Pod. That's No Other Way, P-O-D. Thank you for listening.